guys. Welcome back to another episode of Persuasion by the Pints. Jonathan Taylor, along with
Sean McCool.
Sean, today we are going to spend some time on writing some killer copy.
There you go. Getting back to the basics with one of the masters.
Yeah. I think it's a good, this is a good follow-up to our last episode on, in a lot of ways, you know, talking about conspiracies and how we're predisposed to cognitive biases and how in copywriting, you can use that to your advantage.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you can do it ethically. Like, it's not necessarily a bad thing. So
that's right. That's all we're talking here is total ethics.
Yes. Yeah. We don't want to be Bond villains. We want to be Bond, right? Or Columbo or whoever your favorite Sherlock Holmes, whoever your favorite superhero guy is. So I mean, we're going to go through, we're not going to go through all 21, but this is from an old PDF back when Clayton Makepeace was doing his total package newsletter. Mm-hmm. And he was giving away a lot of bonuses. So this is one of those bonuses that is still out there on the interwebs. And he's got 21, I think he calls them non-rules because they're not rules. Because he doesn't really believe in rules. He hates rules. So 21 tips, tricks, and tactics, key lessons learned from nearly 40 years in the trenches. So we'll be going through not all 21 of these, but some of the highlights. And it's even a couple I kind of still disagree with. And I'll explain why. But yeah, we'll go through these. It's a really good document. I've got a link that we can put on the show notes page as well where people can find it because definitely not in print anymore. And you can't get it anymore, but there are some places on the interwebs to find it. So I cannot vouch for the sites, whatever we post. So I wouldn't necessarily download it. I would probably bookmark it.
So I printed this. I was telling you, we were talking before the show. So I printed this off, like, I want to say this was probably about 12 years ago, going back 12 years ago. And I went through and just went through a lot of his PDFs, printed these out, put them in just a kind of a sloppily put them into a little folder and had stuck it on my bookshelf. I was going through the bookshelf last week, just kind of clearing out some things that didn't need anymore.
Yep.
You know how you do, kind of cleaning out a little clutter. And I pulled this out and I'm like, wow, I haven't looked at this in quite some time. So I started going through it.
Doing a little fall cleaning, huh? A little fall cleaning.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly.
Why wait till spring when you can clean in the fall? Yep. So plus you're not on the road right now. So although you were traveling a couple weeks ago, right? You were traveling out to my neck of the woods.
Not quite here, but flew out to Dallas, spent a few days.
We flip-flopped, right? I went to Tampa, you came to Dallas. Yeah, so.
But I got to tell you, I did get my first Buc-ee's experience.
Oh, did you drive out or did you fly out?
No, I flew out. I flew to Dallas. I was in the Dallas-Fort Worth area for about 3 days because I went out there, met with some potential prospects and clients out there for a couple of days. And it was kind of cool because I was staying like in the Arlington area, just right outside of Dallas, and kind of use that as my I just stayed there for like 3 days at got a hotel there and kind of traveled around, but got a chance like a couple of days there. And one day I stopped by to stop at a Buc-ee's.
One of the new ones, the big ones.
It was huge, man.
Yeah. I mean, isn't it crazy?
30 pumps and like, wow. I walked in the place and I texted my wife. I'm like, you'd be amazed at this place. And I did try the brisket. Oh man, it is one of the best.
They put out sandwiches. And they literally put out probably a ton a day. Like, I mean, they're just making sandwiches as fast as they can make them. And a whole 26, 30 foot, a deli worth of beef jerky and stuff. Like, it's insane. It is a marketing. It is like the Disney of convenience stores.
It is. It's amazing. So if you ever get a chance, you need to stop at a Buc-ee's and pick up their, if you love brisket, try their brisket sandwich. I stopped in, it was like 4 PM. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, well, it's a little before dinner, but I got to try. So I picked up one of these sandwiches and a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Really good coffee.
Yeah.
Even better brisket. So
yeah, pulled pork is really good too for us Georgia boys. Like, oh yeah. You know, old school barbecue. When you couldn't afford brisket, you did pulled pork.
That's right.
So
that's right. Absolutely.
All right, well, let's talk a little beverage before we jump into how to write killer ads and compelling sales copy, because it's always better with beer.
It is, excuse me, always better with beer.
And this beer that I'm going to be featuring today is sponsored by
the Craft Beer Club, but they are the original Craft Beer Club. Not just any craft beer club. They are the original.
Absolutely.
And we are pleased to have them on. They offer some of the finest independent selections of brews in the US of A. I might have just mixed that all up. But anyway, it doesn't matter. One of the best ways to sample all of their unique beers is by letting the original Craft Beer Club do all the legwork and tasting by bringing you all of these beer discoveries right to your home. And Sean, you've got a drink. You can tell us a little bit about it, but if you're interested in learning about it, you know, if you're stuck in, you may be in an area listening to our show where it's like you're still kind of locked down, or it's still kind of crazy to get out, or maybe you don't want to make the trip out to your, you know, your local beverage joint that you pick up your selections. This is a great way to not have to deal with that. It just comes right to your door.
Yep.
And so you can check them out over at persuasionbythepint.com/ craft beer and learn more. And I guess you'll be sharing your latest selection of the month.
Yeah. So yeah, this is great because I haven't really been out much. I mean, I work from home anyway. So, and then just, don't want to get dressed up in full PPE gear to go to the grocery store. So
look like Walter White coming out of a cook.
So I decided, this has been really convenient. So I got, this is from last month, and I got my new November shipment actually last night. Mm-hmm. But this is another one from Gilgamesh Brewing. If you did not get to hear the backstory on Gilgamesh Brewing, go back and listen to the last episode where we talked about kind of a very cool old story that they pulled to name their brewing company after. There are demigods and kings and stuff involved. So if you like that kind of stuff, go back and listen to the last episode where we talk about that. But this beer, this is like the complete opposite of what I had on the last episode. So the last episode, Jonathan, I had a double IPA that had 87 IBUs, right? So pretty hoppy and bitter and that kind of stuff. This one is called Mamba. And I don't love their cans. Like they don't show up real well on camera. So this is a malt ale. It's 6.5% ABV, one IBU.
One. Wow.
One. I don't know if I've ever seen one that low.
I've never seen a one IBU.
Yeah. So this says it's a mysterious and unique malt ale. The Gilgamesh Mamba is brewed with black tea and tangerine peel to create a lightly flavored and smooth bodied brew that's easy drinking, even for those who claim they don't like beer. Hints of bergamot and rye add further dimension to this ale with a taste that can only speak for itself. How about that?
How about that? Well, I gotta know what a one IBU tastes like, because I mean,
yeah,
it sounds totally crazy.
Yeah, like I don't know where like a Bud Light would fall on IBUs, because they don't label that kind of stuff. So that would be interesting to know, just from a comparison standpoint. But I guess because it's called a malt ale. So my guess is there's no hops. So I guess anything without hops is probably not going to have much IBU involved.
Right.
And it may just be in this one, the tangerine that's causing that. All right. Well, we'll see in here in a minute. Yeah, what do you have? So this is the pour. It's definitely got a kind of an orange, orange look to it.
A little redness.
Red and it's, I don't know exactly what's going on there. Black tea and tangerine. We're about to find out.
All right. What do you have? So I got a 1050 from
1050 baby. Oh yeah. 1050 baby.
A little Oscar Brews action going here.
I've I've had that one. I know.
So, oh, is it good? Okay. All right.
So, I don't remember if it was good, but I do remember the name. I mean, how could you forget that name?
How could you? I mean, 50 Cent, you know, just, he's been in the news lately. So you kind of association there, a little persuasion association in terms of, linking. And, so this one's an American Imperial Stout, 10.5 ABV. So a little heavy there.
Finishing strong. I like it. Finishing the night strong.
Says this Titanic, immensely viscous stout. Viscous.
Thick.
Very right? thick. Very thick stout is loaded with flavors of chocolate-covered caramel and coffee. Mm. And they hide a hefty 90. Oh, whoa. Here we go. 98 IBUs.
Wow.
They hide. How do they hide? They hide a hefty 98. Okay. So that's interesting. You had, what was it? 89 on the
previous? 87 on the previous. And this is one. So we're going the opposite extreme.
So I'm at 98 to one IBUs. Okay. So 98 IBUs underneath a smooth blanket of malt. Hmm. It is made with enormous amounts of two row malt. I have no, what's two rows? Two rows of malt.
I don't know.
Chocolate malt, roasted barley, flaked oats, and hops. So I don't know. You know, I'm looking at Beer Advocate. They give it a 97 score. So
wow,
we'll see.
I don't remember hating it. So I think 1050 is kind of like the 10W50 type. You know, kind of like the 1040 that they make. I think you had a few shows back. That is dark.
It's dark. Look at that
head, man. Like even the head is brown. Like it's, it's dark.
Very foamy. And maybe I didn't pour it perfectly, but still I didn't pour it direct.
Wow. That is something else.
All right. So now is the moment of truth. Here we go. All right. Cheers.
Cheers.
Ooh, that's amazing. Hmm. Yeah. 50 Cent would be proud. I don't know if he drinks Imperial Stouts.
I don't know.
I doubt it.
Mine is, mine's really good, but I'm surprised it was in a October shipment. This definitely feels like a June, July kind of beer. Mm-hmm. But it's almost more like it. I can see why they say it's for those that don't like beer, because it does not taste like beer. It almost tastes more like, not so far as a wine cooler. It doesn't have that taste, but it does taste more like maybe a hard, one of the hard drinks, you know, like the, so it's pretty good, but it's definitely doesn't taste like beer. It didn't have a lot of head or carbonation to it. Mm-hmm. Definitely taste the tangerine. Don't really taste the black tea, but I could seriously like sip on this on the front porch in a rocking chair in the summer.
Sure.
You could definitely sip on this all day long. So I actually really like it.
It looks like tea. Mm-hmm. You could put some ice in there and I would be, I just think it's a glass iced tea.
There you go. So it's a stealth beer. Because it's, you know, it's, I mean, it's a solid, what was it, 6.5? Mm-hmm. So it's pretty good. Yeah, you know, it's pretty strong beer overall. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I like it. I'm going to give this a four. Mm-hmm. I think an Erden's a four.
That's true. Yeah.
If it was 100 degrees out, I'd probably give it a 4.2 or something. But right now, mm-hmm. I'm going to give it a four because I'm really craving the, what you're having basically. So, but yeah, no, this is good. How about, so you had a great response on the first sip. So on your third sip there, where are you at on the score?
Really good. So if you had told me this was 98 IBUs, I would have laughed at you. So
yeah.
They have definitely, you know, what do they say? They're trying to, they hit the hefty 98 IBUs underneath the smooth blanket of malt. That's some good copy right there.
Oh yeah, I like that. Some Barry White stuff going on right there.
A smooth blanket of malt. Now, this is good. I'm going to have to give this one a 4. I'm going to give this one a 4.7. Really good. 10.5 ABV.
So a lot of times when you get that strong, especially in a, is it Imperial Stout?
Yeah, it is in a, it is an Imperial Stout.
A lot of times those get too sweet when you get up in that range. But that one's about right.
They balanced it out. You know, they got the 98 IBUs, you know, and they've apparently hidden it with that. Here we go. With the smooth blanket.
Nothing like a smooth blanket of malt. Man, that just makes the IBUs just disappear.
That's it, man.
All right.
It's good. Well, I recommend it. So you say you've had this before.
Yeah.
This is my first time. It's amazing. I love it.
Yeah, I think I had that up at a Honeybee Cafe there in Knoxville at one point, and they're from their cooler. So
it's a four. I think it's like a four. Yeah, it's a, like a four pack, like a little box. Oh,
of course. Yeah, of course it is. And it's probably 36, and like
50 bucks, 30, I think.
Yeah, like yeah, 36.99. Yeah. All right. Yeah, dollar per ABV for the four pack. So $40 or something. All right, so let's talk about
killer.
How to write killer ads and compelling sales copy. A little alliteration going on there with different letters.
Yep.
The old hard C never fails. Coca-Cola has proven that. All right, so I'm going to let you jump in. We'll go, just kind of go down the list. We'll bounce around a little bit. But obviously, this caught your attention when you dusted it off from the old bookshelf and fall cleaning. So... What like what really jumped out at you? What was the first non-rule that jumped out at you?
I think the first two, which is to, or actually the first three, are so important because you can apply these not only for, you know, people, you know, when you're copywriting, but I think any types of, you're writing emails, like corporate emails or things like that, sales letters, individual sales letters to companies, but come across, I think too often we have a tendency, not so much, I think it's easier in the copy world, copywriting world, because you're obviously you're, this has been taught. So this is really nothing new, but the importance of being somebody and not like, you know, putting your face and not like the face of a company, you know, being personal, having like a personal feel. It says, be somebody. We tend to be skeptical, even suspicious of information given to us by a corporation or a company. So anytime you're, you know, you're writing sales copy, you want to make sure that you're writing on a personal level and that they have a face, that you have a face on your copy as someone who is writing from you, you know, writing to your audience. And it's funny because I was listening to a podcast this week. I think it was Scott Adams, and he's got a very popular podcast. And I think one of the takeaways from him is like, he's like, I think one of the reasons why my podcast is really popular is because I'm like talking to you. Like I'm like talking to you when I'm having a conversation on my podcast. It's like, I'm just talking to you one-on-one.
Right.
And not like I'm just talking to a huge audience. So yeah. I think that's important. Like anybody, if you notice anybody, not only in sales copy, but anybody in radio or in podcasting, if they're talking to their audience, when they're having this conversation or this monologue, it's usually they focus it in. The good ones really focus it in. Like they're having a conversation with you. They're talking directly to you and not this vague audience out there. But I think putting a face on that is really important.
Yeah. You see this on the, you know, going back to just cause it's the hot topic right now, just, you know, the political stuff, you see both the candidates and you see, the opinion shows on the different news networks that come on in the evenings. They do a good job of this. They talk directly to their their group that is believes in them, whether you're watching, you know, Tucker Carlson or you're watching, you know, Rachel Maddow, either side, they're talking to their viewer, you know, straight on directly. Yeah. Like, can you believe the nerve of these people? You know, and they're both saying the same thing with different characters, right? It's the same thing.
And I agree. I think those two people are the best at it. Rachel Maddow on her side, Tucker Carlson on his side are the best, are two of the best in that, in that type of industry where it's, you know, it's not really news, it's opinion news, you know, it's right, opinion. Yeah,
it's entertainment. Let's be honest.
But they're good. If you look at their, body language and the way they talk, they're not talking to, it's not talking to, they don't, you feel like you're the person that they're directing the conversation to. And absolutely. So it's amazing how they can do that. I think that, a lot of times it takes a skill, especially somebody that's behind a camera, to be able to do that.
Yep.
But in copywriting, you know, you have to do that as well. You have to put a face on it, be personal, talk to your audience. And it's so easy. I think sometimes when you're writing copy for a company or for a corporation, they easily fall into the trap of blah, blah, blah. And I see it on, it's not just emails, but it's on companies that I've worked with, company literature, websites, brochures, you know, online literature, all the stuff, PDFs, white papers, so forth. All of it is sometimes the mistake is treating it as just a corporate, speak.
And let's talk about what are the alternatives, right? So mm-hmm. You could be the CEO,
yep,
which is what a lot of people would think. But it could also be, you could have a different email come from the accounting department. You could have another mm-hmm. one come from the warehouse guy. And I did this when I worked with a company. And, sometimes I would send emails from the CEO, or I'd write an ad in the voice of the CEO. And other times, there was another time where they had a repair program where you could send back this piece of tooling equipment. Mm-hmm. And they would repair it for you. So I wrote it in the voice of the repairman.
Sure. Right?
Because
that's great.
And it was actually a really successful ad that we ran for still, it's probably still running actually. But even if you don't have a person, there are times when you can, depending on, how much guts you have. And I don't mm-hmm. think it takes a lot of guts, but you do have to kind of let the ego go away.
Right.
You can have a pet or a dog, right? You see that from time to time, where you'll see somebody where the dog is. GoRuck is a good example, right? They mm-hmm. send their emails from their chocolate lab or black lab, I can't remember which it is, whose name is Monster, and Monster writes all the emails, right? All the stuff is from Monster, and they put his picture in it. So, what's cool about that is you can get away with a lot more if you use a dog or even a cartoon character.
Absolutely.
It doesn't have to be a person in the company. It could be a pen name. It can be mm-hmm. something else. So don't get hung up that it has to be a person in the company. And in some cases, especially if you're like a fast growing company or in a maybe you've got high turnover just because you're growing so fast or whatever, mm-hmm. you may want something like a mascot or something like that that's not going to change over time. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, don't be afraid to put some personality into it, Pick a dog, one of my friends, she's in the pet industry. So her dog, her bulldog is on all her Instagram. Like that's the face of the company literally the face of the company is her English bulldog. And she writes most of her ads and stuff in the voice of Mavis, the bulldog.
Yeah.
It's also frees you up. Like you don't, I think when you write copy, when it's not you writing it and signing it, it's easier to write, right? Because it doesn't have to be perfect. It's like, this is a dog writing it. So mm-hmm. people are going to give me a little bit more leeway, and they will.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you like the first three. So what was the next one?
Just to follow up with what you said, commercial that I really... from a commercial standpoint, you ever seen the MyPillow commercials?
How could I not? Like they're everywhere. Especially if you watch Fox News for more than 10 minutes.
That's right. That's right. Cause they're all over. But just from a personal standpoint, that whole personalization, cause he does all the commercials. He's the CEO, obviously.
Yep.
Mike something or other, but the guy's like, he personalizes it. If you look at the conversation, he's having a personal conversation, like he's like explaining it. So it's easy to me, it's easier to trust because it's not coming from, corporate speak. It's coming from the guy. It's a very personal. So I would encourage anybody to watch those, you know, watch some of his commercials, because they have that personal appeal, kind of that, you know, obviously he puts a face on it. He's standing there, you know, just an average good looking guy, you know, talking about it. So
I think what it is, you know, people want to know that if something's not right with the product or the company, that there's somebody behind it that's going to take responsibility. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's almost subconscious. I don't think we like process that, but if it's just this, you know, if I'm just dealing with Apple, I'm like, well, there's a lot of people at Apple. Who do I call if I have a problem, right? Where if Steve Jobs comes on and says, hey, I stand behind this computer, or, you know, and you see, what was the other Men's Warehouse? You know, they do that, right?
Yep.
George Zimmerman, he did that really well when he was in charge of that before they sold off. But he's like, you know, I guarantee it.
Sure.
Like, and there was some comfort in that. You're like, okay, all right. He's willing to get on camera and say he guarantees it. Mm-hmm. What was the other one? The identity theft thing where the guy
put
Social Security on the on TV.
Yep.
That's pretty gutsy right there.
Right.
You know, so that kind of stuff has a huge impact. You don't have to go to that extreme. Mm-hmm. But those also became, you know, $100 million plus companies. So
absolutely
something to it. Right.
Yep.
And we, one more example and then we'll move on. But like when I fly Delta typically when I fly, and the announcement is always, you know, the pre-flight announcement is always from the CEO on the video, the safety video. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have to do that. But the CEO always comes on. It's, it's a new CEO now than what it was, you know, a year ago when I was flying. Right. So, it just adds a little bit of like, okay, he cares enough to take the time out of his day. Like, he would have to do that. He could get the marketing department to do that. And he steps up and he does it. So definitely has some weight to it. And you may ask people if they like that or don't like that, and they probably wouldn't even notice necessarily, but subconsciously, I think it definitely registers with people.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So on to number two, non-rule number two.
Okay. So here's the one I'm skipping ahead to, because number two is address your prospect directly, which is kind of like, you know, we kind of cover personal.
Yeah. I do want to say one thing about that though.
Yeah. Yeah.
That does not, in fact, it's not compliant on Facebook. So when you're writing ads on Facebook, or if your landing page from your Facebook ad to, talks directly to the reader in a negative kind of way, like a downplay kind of way. For instance, he says here, the example he gives is, as an American over age 40, your chances are one in X of having a heart attack this year. Mm-hmm. That would actually be not compliant on Facebook, and it would get your ad disabled.
Sure. Yeah.
So these are great rules. And if you're doing email, absolutely do it. Or if you're on some other platform, but if you're on Facebook, and I know a lot of people advertise on Facebook, you would have to keep it a little bit more general.
Oh, so Facebook ads are tough. Yeah, they're a challenge.
It's been a brutal week at the old at the agency with Facebook. So it's crazy. So I just wanted to put that in there, because that is a change from traditional direct response principles that you cannot do on one of the largest advertising platforms in the world right now. You actually can't do it. You can do it as long as it's positive.
Sure.
But even then, you can't, like, you couldn't say American over 40, because that would be too identifying.
Yeah.
And people, they don't want people to feel like they know exactly who they are, even though they know exactly who they are.
Sure. Yeah.
They got to keep something mysterious, right? So,
man,
they don't want everybody to know they have 400,000 pieces of data on you. All right. So what were you going to skip ahead to?
Well, this one probably would get you delisted on Facebook as well, but it's one that, so the first three, I'm going to cruise through the first three, because I mentioned be personal, talk directly, which is all, these are all kind of fall in the same category. Be personal, talk directly to your audience. You know, be able to, you know, have an identity behind you. So the people can recognize you. This one kind of follows up. This next one follows up on our last episode with conspiracies and how we're wired.
Yeah.
So being number five is rule number five, skipping ahead, is put a face on the enemy. And we talked about that on the previous episode. It's like, you know, we're predisposed, our brains are wired with through our biases to have want to like put our problems on someone else. So here's what he says. Why has the reader failed to solve this problem or fulfilled his desire? Were all the other products he tried ineffective? Were the expert who gave him advice wrong? Is someone intentionally using him? So these are the questions. So remember what we said, the big statement, it's not your fault, is used in copy all the time. So if you're not rich, if you're not slim, if you're not muscular, if you don't have a healthy lifestyle, it's really not your fault. It's all of these things out there that have really prevented you. And so that's the importance, because again, like we said on the previous episode, with how our brains like to simplify things and like to put all of our problems on some kind of scapegoat, whether it's Donald Trump or George Soros or, you know, the fitness industry or this industry.
Yep.
You know, big pharma. You know, big pharma is the big, you know, boogeyman out there.
Yep.
Everybody's got a scapegoat. And so in copy, it's all about placing, you know, and this is not, it can be used unethically sometimes, but there's a balance there.
You know, I think it's kind of like what we said about conspiracy theories. If you pick an enemy that has a little bit of truth to it.
A little bit. Yeah, exactly.
For instance, in the weight loss space, if you, if you talk about food manufacturers, I mean, for instance, you can go buy a pack of jelly beans, right? Jelly beans are like one of my favorite little snacks, right? I love jelly beans.
You and Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, exactly. I'm an 80s kid. What can I say? So like, but you know what it says on that package? Like it has a big starburst on every jelly, just about it. It doesn't matter which brand you buy.
Right.
It says a fat-free food. Like they're trying to spin it. Mm-hmm. As something that's not bad for you. This is a fat-free food.
Absolutely.
So there is some, that's absolutely 100% true, but it's also absolutely 100% spin by that company. So when you can point stuff out like that, it's both true and it does let your prospect, your reader off the hook a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because they are, if you haven't done the research like you and I have done, you know, in that niche or something, you know, and you're kind of new to the weight loss, you know, that is kind of, you don't know that, you know, mm-hmm. right? So it is kind of, you know, hidden from you. So I think one thing when you're in a niche a lot, especially if you're a marketer in that niche, you take a lot of things for granted. And like, you know that that's spin, but a lot of your prospects won't.
No.
But even ones that have tried other stuff, other marketers may not have done a good job of pointing that out.
Sure.
You know, so if you were writing a sales letter, for instance, you could show like six different types of food mm-hmm. where they show, well, this one's fat free or this one's high protein, but the fat free, you know, both of them are full of sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Because you see these new lean cuisine meals that are like, 26 grams of protein. You turn it over and it's got 5,000 grams of sugar in it. Right.
Oh, yeah.
Because if they
load with sodium, sugar, all the stuff that's
or they'll say it's fat free because people are scared of fat,
right?
Well, to keep the taste in, they've got to up something else, salt, sugar, something else, right? So if you could show those things in your advertising, and that's true in any industry, right? Mm-hmm. Whether you're selling like you sell composites or like whatever, there's always somebody trying to kind of those dang marketers. They're always trying to tell half truths. And if you can expose those half truths, then you become the trusted person. Everybody else becomes the enemy.
Yeah. There was a guy years ago that had a book out on things they don't like. He was like, he branded himself. I don't know if you're
Kevin Trudeau, right?
Yeah. Kevin Trudeau.
Yeah.
But he branded himself as the
full disclosure. He's in jail now. He's in jail. just so we're clear. Yeah, but they don't want you to know series.
Yeah, exactly. He was exposing the truths they don't want you to know, but yeah, he
So they put him in jail. It's a conspiracy theory.
The enemies, the villains out there, put him in jail. Yes.
You know, our buddy David Dutton is like his pen pal, his prison pen pal. Did you know that?
You're kidding. I did not know that.
No, they've been writing letters back and forth.
Wow.
Yeah, like it's crazy. So, yeah, David Dutton. Of course, it would be David Dutton of all of our friends.
Of course, most connected. We got. I got to bring David on the. We got to bring him on the
just
show.
Just don't make him fly to your studio because he won't. He won't fly.
That's amazing. So, how long is he in? Do you know what? How much time he's serving? Or
I don't, but David could probably tell you.
Yeah, this would be a good, interesting conversation. I'm going to talk to David about this.
Yeah.
You're right. It's like the truths, the pharmaceutical or the food industry or the health or the fitness or the bankers, those evil bankers who are those robber barons out there. Everyone, there's always an enemy that you can pinpoint all of your problems on. And that's a lot of times effective copy does that,
So I just looked it up. Here's his book titles, right? Mm-hmm. Natural cures they don't want you to know about.
That's right.
The weight loss cure they don't want you to know about. Debt cures they don't want you to know about.
Again, feeds into what we just talked about last episode. Yeah. Feeds into conspiracy.
Yeah.
Conspiracy where people are predisposed to simple reasoning, a simple reasoning as to why, certain things aren't working out in their life,
And these were huge, best-selling books. I mean, these were like, multi-million dollar selling mm-hmm. books. And it's exactly what we said. It's not your fault, right? So debt cures, they don't want you to know about, right? So there's this force out there, this group, the Illuminati, the Bilderberg group, like all those groups, the banker cartel, the banking cartel, big banks, big pharma, right now it's big tech as well. Like, they're all conspiring against you, so it's not your fault. But here's what they don't want you to know. It's only 1995. Grab it while you can. Before they put me in jail.
Yeah, so you have to be careful with this. There's a reason why he's behind bars right now, which is a lot,
Yeah.
You got to know your stuff when you're in this industry, I guess, so to speak. Yep.
All right.
So next, here's one that this is going to be a little, you're going to give a little devil's advocate here. Mm-hmm. Number six, prove every point. So I'm going to read this and you're going to challenge this point. Never ask your reader to accept any claim at face value. Always include proof elements that suspend his disbelief with every claim. So I think, and I'm going to say obviously, you're going to give your side. I'm going to say from a standpoint in my industry, this is very effective because mm-hmm. I work, in my industry, I write, I'll not necessarily sales copy, but I'm really direct. I'll do direct response. Response marketing to a lot of companies. But he says best credibility devices to use are study data from respected sources, expert testimonials, user testimonials, statements that support your point from a major periodical. So,
right.
You're going to say what?
So there's two sides to this, right? And one is, I think it was, Doberman Dan, when he was a guest on the show, he actually said that he wrote a promo one time for Agora, and he decided not to use much proof, and that actually did better than anything he'd done before. I don't know if you remember that conversation. Mm-hmm. And the copy chief there was like, yeah, that seems about right. Proof is overrated.
Sure.
So that's part of it. Here's the thing. And I just did a training on this week. For some marketers, but if you're trying to change somebody's mind, proof is pointless and useless. I've come to believe that I've come to believe that proof is basically and really only effective for people who already believe kind of in the realm of what you're trying to get them to believe.
Okay.
Right. So it's a good proof is great to confirm someone's bias. It's not great to try to change someone's mind.
Okay.
And you've probably had that experience personally, right?
Yeah, like absolutely.
You can use proof and they'll like nod their head if they already agree with it. But if you try to change their mind, the proof actually makes them angrier and more stubborn.
That's absolutely
so I think you have to be careful. No. And in marketing, and this was the conversation I was having with people, you should really only be marketing to people that have the worldview. Like you need to market to people's current worldview. You don't want to try to change their worldview.
Right.
Now you could sell the same product to both worldviews. Mm-hmm. I can sell Budweiser to, well, no, I can't. Well, we go back, like we talked about on the last episode, I was talking about BMW 5 Series versus a Honda Accord.
Yeah.
I'm never going to sell a Honda Accord to a BMW 5 Series buyer because the 5 Series buyer is you get what you pay for. You know, I deserve this because I've worked hard and I can afford it.
Sure.
The Honda Accord buyer is, it's just a car. It just gets me from point A to point B. It's foolish to spend extra money for something that's just a utility product, right?
Right.
I don't care how much proof you give that a Honda Accord is the same basic mode of transportation. You'll never convince the 5 Series buyer to buy the Accord.
Right.
No matter how much proof you have, no matter how many expert testimonials, no matter how many write-ups in Consumer Reports or the Wall Street Journal, that the 5 Series buyer is not going to buy a Honda Accord.
Sure.
So I think what I've come to discover in writing copy and marketing is proof is very effective as long as it's already in line with what they already believe. Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, why do you even need proof then? Some people would say, like Dan said in our episode, you may not. You may just need the emotional part.
Yeah.
So this is something I think that's kind of a recent understanding. You know, people buy with emotion and then you justify with logic has always been the thing.
Absolutely.
But if people buy with emotion, maybe you don't need to justify with logic. Maybe you just need to get them to buy with emotion.
That's right.
You know, yeah. I mean, if you think about a lot of the things you buy, like, you know,
depends on who in their world they're trying to.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. You have to know your person. You have to understand their worldview and how they come at the world. Right.
That's right.
But every time I've bought a new car, it's never been a rational decision and I've never based it on proof or studies mm-hmm. or anything else. Right. But I'm not an engineer or that type of person. Sure. that might need that kind of stuff. So I think you just have to be aware of and really be in tune with who your avatar is and what their worldview is.
Right.
And then the marketing
is going to be like dependent. Wouldn't you say that, you know, if you're marketing to a single person, you could probably leave off the, you know, the needing to justify that with logic. You know, let's say a single guy in their 20s who is not married,
yeah,
that have a lot of responsibility as opposed to a guy that's got, you know, that's married, has kids, you know, that may need to justify that purchase mm-hmm. to their significant other. So that's a whole different ballgame. You
know? Right.
Yeah. So they need that emotion, but they also need the logic to understand in that equation.
Right. Yes and no, because I would say they're going to buy it either way. Right. So
you're making it easier for them.
Right. You're making it easier after the purchase for them to have less buyer's remorse, which is important, right?
Yeah. It's like the guy, let me explain. It's like the guy, you remember the scene, Glengarry Glen Ross, remember that scene where he sells the guy the property, mm-hmm. you know, right?
Yep. Yep.
He sells it completely. He's sitting down with him at the restaurant, man. Al Pacino is so smooth in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of salesmanship and persuasion. If you've never seen this movie, Glenn Ross.
So this is so weird. I was in a meeting this morning, my daily huddle with my team.
Right.
There's like 8 or 9 people.
Yep.
right? And I mentioned this movie. Literally, I mentioned this morning in our team huddle, and none of them had seen or heard of the movie.
Oh my gosh.
Because they're all like under 30.
That is so sad.
Finally, one person came on to the meeting late and they knew the movie, so I was redeemed. But I was like, oh my God, that's your homework assignment for this weekend. You're fired. Absolutely. If you don't come back on Monday and give me a synopsis of the movie, you're fired. But anyway, I digress. But it's funny that that came up. That's so weird.
Yeah, to me, it's a good example of what you're just talking about, because in the scene, he does a brilliant job of persuasion. He's in a restaurant. Or he's sitting down having drinks with a prospect, sells him on a piece of land, clearly from an emotional standpoint.
Yep.
The guy goes home the next day. The guy comes in and he reneges on the deal because his wife got a hold of him, said, "What are you doing? You're an
idiot." He didn't have the
logic to back himself up to give to his wife. Right. So it's a brilliant scene. But I think that where he missed out in the movie was being able to justify that to his significant other, knowing.
Well, I'll tell you this. That's a good point, because I know when I've sold high ticket type coaching or anything else like that.
Right.
And I'm only selling to one person. So I know a guy. So, for instance, I'm selling to a guy or a gal that's married, but I'm only talking to them on the phone. Like a lot of sales trainers will say, never talk to just one person in a married couple, like get them both on the phone.
Yep.
I didn't do that. But what I did do is I would, after they agreed to move forward and they agreed to the price and everything else, I would then start to interrogate them about what they're going to say at these different stages that I knew were coming in the next 24 to 36 hours. Right.
Absolutely.
So for instance, I charge a lot for my one-on-one coaching, and they have to send a wire transfer to pay my fee because it's all up front, no refunds, all up front.
Absolutely.
Right. So I know that when they go to the bank and they're making this big of a wire transfer, right, that the banker's going to ask, "Are you sure you know who this person is?" Right. Because, I mean, it's kind of the banker's job to protect their clients. And
yeah,
but also bankers are investors. Or investment advisors, right? So if they see a chunk of cash that could go into a CD, they're going to question that, right? Because it's leaving their bank and going somewhere else.
Right.
So it's kind of their job to create this. So I have to prepare my sale that this is going to happen and prepare them exactly what the banker's going to say. When I used to sell annuities back in early 2000s, a lot of times that money would come out of CDs to go into the annuities that I was selling.
Right.
And they had to go down to the bank to make the transfer a lot of times. Right. So I would have to prepare them for that conversation. And I would say, here's what your banker is going to say. They're going to say this, this, and this. And sure enough, that's what the banker would say. So because I had pre-addressed it, then when the banker said it, and I usually gave a reason, like they're going to say this because they want to keep this money and they want to loan it out to Johnny down the street for a used car at 12% instead of giving you that money. Like we're going to give you twice the rate they're giving you.
Right.
You know, and it's your money and it's safe. It's not going to be in some teenager's new car that he's going to total next week and then not going to want to pay for. And he's going to default on the payment, blah, blah, blah. Right. So, and that's literally like part of the script I would use. So you do, I think that's a good point. Like, it's not going to make the sale, but it could hold the sale and keep the sale from going back on you.
Absolutely.
It'll help with refunds.
There's always that buyer's remorse afterward that can take place. And sometimes it's not their buyer's remorse, but the fact that they're getting pressured by, you know, people that are outside, you know, that are close to them, they can influence that. And so you have to keep that in mind, you know.
Absolutely.
So.
All right. Well, let's see. Let's see if we can knock out a few more before the hour's up.
Yeah. So there's 21. We're not going to hit all of them. Maybe we could, like, on a follow-up episode, we could cover some more, but I want to reach out, speak colloquially. Why is this so hard? Speak colloquially.
I'll tell you why that's a hard word, because nobody that speaks colloquially would ever use that word. Isn't that ironic that, like, the word that means to speak in common language is like hard to say.
It's really hard,
right? I mean, that's what it means, right? Colloquially means to speak in common language.
That's right.
Or like what people are used to be spoken in. And then they use this big fancy word to describe a simple concept. So that had to be an English major that did that. And by the way, this, we were talking about this before the show, like this is what, from about, you know, 10th grade English on through college, this is like one of the things that gets your paper, your essay marked up more than anything, right? Is to, if, well, a lot of these things actually, like speaking directly to the reader, like all this stuff is stuff that you just don't do in typical English papers and things like that. And that's one of the things when I work with copywriters, especially if they went to college, because whether you were an English major or not, you had to write papers in that style, right? The Chicago, whatever it is. And I flunked out, so I don't know. Whatever
the manual of style.
Yeah, whatever those are, like those things. Like that doesn't work in copy. Like you need to be more casual. You know, you need to be, you need to use the language of your avatar and the words that they would use, which is also on number 9 and number 10 are kind of the same vein, right? So all jargon is not evil is number 9.
Sure.
Figures of speech are wonderful is rule number 10.
Right.
So these are all kind of in the same realm. Like jargon is really, really good in a lot of cases because it lets people know that you know the industry.
Yeah.
So one of the most famous subscription letters of all time is this, is the one called Trout Spoken Here. It was for Fly Fisherman Magazine. And the whole beginning of the letter is like all these, all this jargon that only a fly fisherman would know.
Yeah.
Like even a bass fisher wouldn't know a lot of the jargon that they were talking about because it's for fly fishermen.
Sure.
And they just rattled off all this stuff in the first, you know, 100 words. So you immediately knew as a fly fisherman that this was the magazine for you.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, now if you're trying to expand your base or you're trying to scale an offer, you might not want to use as much jargon.
Right.
But if you're trying to sell to your key, you know, your ideal avatar that already knows the industry, you probably do want to use jargon. Yeah, because it demonstrates, as he says in here, jargon by an expert demonstrates expertise.
Yeah.
Because of course you would speak jargon if you're an expert in the field.
Right. Yeah, and that's a prime example of the industry that I'm in where, you know, using jargon, industry jargon is actually a good thing, you know, because people recognize it. And
they know you know your stuff.
That's right. That's right.
So it creates trust and rapport and everything else. They're like, oh, this isn't some new guy. He's obviously been in the industry a while.
Yeah.
You know, whereas if you came in and like were stumbling around and you were just talking about, you know, vague concepts, they'd be like, it's the new guy.
Yeah.
Right.
Doesn't sound like you exactly know what's going on here. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And then number 10 was like figures of speech. So this is, this is one thing I know Clayton, I worked with Clayton a few times, you know, on projects, and I know one thing he loved is cliches.
Yeah.
Like he abs, I've actually got a whole, you know, one of these same kind of PDFs that he printed out. That's just absolutely full of cliches, like 20, 30 pages of cliches. And that's one of the things that your English teacher in both high school and college, that's the first thing they redlined in your paper was cliches. But the fact is, like, cliches, like, they resonate.
Sure.
But, and they sound so true because people just accept them as fact, you know? It's like, trying to think of one right off the top of my head and just went blank. But, you know, even like, so this is kind of a colloquial thing, you know, as nervous as a cat in a room full of rocking chairs.
Yep.
That's a good Southern expression, right?
Sure.
So you know, you say that, you automatically kind of know, okay, this guy must be one of us. He's from the South. If he's using phrases like that, or Texas or somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And I'm sure the Northeast has their things, and like, you know,
busier than a two-headed cat in a fish house.
Yeah, there you go. those kind of things, what? Like to certain parts of the country, they'd be like, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. But to other parts, they're like, I know exactly what he's talking about. Sure. Right.
Exactly.
So using cliches, if they're used in the right way, is really, really powerful.
Absolutely.
All right. Yeah. Where do you want to go from here?
Since we're running short, is there one more you feel like you want to touch on before?
Let me look. I think we could pick, this is probably a good stopping point to kind of pick up. We could do another episode on.
Oh, I agree. These are all fantastic. And, we'll pick this up on a follow-up episode.
Yes.
About 75, just to tease our upcoming episode. This would be a good one. 75 most powerful words and phrases in the English language that can work for you.
All right. Wow. Yeah. That's worth the cost of the podcast right there.
That's right. Because, you know, we've had
that's like worth a year's worth of, you know, what it costs you to listen to these episodes. I mean, it's just in that one thing.
So remember, you know, we've had Bob Bly on a previous episode to talk about his book, Big Words That Sell. Mm-hmm. Some of these words are not in Bob's book. They're really good.
So. Yes. I see a couple that like, it's so funny because you kind of get in a rut when you write your own marketing. And even as a copywriter, professional copywriter, like you tend to gravitate to the same four or five words.
Right.
And the fact that there's 75 on this list is pretty cool. So let me just scroll and look at, tease a couple more. So we'll talk about the, the types of sentences that rule and those that drool, I guess.
Yep.
What you should do with commas. We'll talk about that.
Yeah.
And let's see. And how to know when to cut your copy. This is something I see all the time when I mentor. I actually just commented. I'm in a group of copywriters and somebody posted. They were asking for like a critique of their email that they wrote. And one of the big mistakes I see in new and upcoming copywriters is that they don't know where to and when to cut. Like after your first draft, like how do you know what to cut? So we can talk about that as well. So that's just three or four of the, probably the remaining 10 points that we could talk about on the next episode.
Oh yeah. Yeah. This is good stuff. That's on our follow-up episode, guys. We thank you for listening. As always, you can find us over at persuasionbythepint.com. You can follow us on all of your podcast platforms. You can also follow us on our group over at facebook.com/groups/persuasionbythepint. Sean, it's been fun, man. See you next week.
See ya.